This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In his new book of essays, Reporting the Universe, novelist E.L. Doctorow writes, "People think naturally in terms of conflict and resolution and in terms of character undergoing events and of the outcome of events not being all sure and therefore suspenseful." E.L. Doctorow joins us now from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
That passage I just quoted, you illustrated with a wonderful passage from an oral history of a Kansas homesteader describing her neighbor's struggles during her husband's bouts of malaria. And she recalls, quote, "When Mr. Briggs was so with it, the malaria, that Mrs. Briggs had to cut the wood, she put the baby behind him on the corded bedstead where his shivering joggled the baby off to sleep." Now, you describe that as her coming to a realization of very important, some very important ideas about writing. Can you describe them for us?
Well, sure. The first thing to say about that line, which is from a collection of oral histories about women who lived and survived with their families in the West in the 19th century, is that writing comes naturally to people, and they do think naturally in terms of stories. The story was the original first system of knowledge that human beings had. Stories taught us how to survive and distributed the suffering so that it could be born. And in this particular line that you just quoted, somehow this writer, this amateur writer, knew what Flaubert, the great French fiction writer, knew, that the way to make an object in fiction exist is to have it worked upon by another object. What makes things come into being is their transaction. Mr. Briggs' illness exists because he shivers, and the bed exists because he lies on it, and the sleeping baby exists because his father's malarial convulsions rock the bedspread. But this writer knew more, and so we learn from Mrs. Briggs' action a good deal of her character, her enterprise in using even her husband's illness in their daily struggle for survival on the prairie. And we know this life is harsh. We can imagine from this sentence alone the homemade nature of the house and perhaps even what things look like outside of the house. And in fact, we could derive from it the entire character of life on the American frontier in the mid-19th century. It's very impressive.
One of the things you write about is that a good writer ought to be able to, from just a snippet of conversation, like perhaps that, be able to develop this whole idea of character and story.
Well, novelists have always known that. It is kind of an act of principle of faith. It was Henry James who elaborated the idea that the writer saw something and from that visible thing could intuit the invisible. He uses the example of a young woman who lived a sheltered life. This is my extrapolation. Walking past an army barracks, on the base of that, if she's a novelist, being able to go home and write an accurate novel about army life. I do believe that. My life hasn't been sheltered, but I can presume to write about places I've never been and in the voices of people other than myself. This is a thing about fiction, and I assume poetry, I'm not a poet, that imaginative writing is an endowment that allows you perhaps to do things that and understand things that strict factual representation could not give you.
E.L. Doctorow will be with us for the better part of this hour. If you'd like to join the conversation and talk about his life, his books, and his ideas, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And you were describing that, the ability to write about places you've never been and people you've never seen. Your first novel, you describe, you determined very early in life that you were a writer. And in fact, you returned from the Army back to New York in the 50s. And you planned to write. You even, had outlines to write, but you couldn't do it.
Yes, I was, I actually decided I was a writer when I was about 9 years old, and for many years I didn't feel it was necessary actually to write anything in order to prove that to myself or anyone else. But by the time I got into my 20s, I was quite serious about writing. And when I did get out of the army, I came home to write and found I couldn't. I constructed outlines for books. I researched subjects for books. I intended to write books, and none of them got written. And at this time, I found work as a professional reader for a film company, and the job called for reading novels and preparing synopses for the film executives who didn't themselves have time to read or perhaps couldn't read, but were on the lookout for stories that could be adapted for the screen. And these days, in the late 50s, Westerns were very popular. And so it was given to me to cover one rotten Western after another, and despairing of my own failed efforts and the wretched pulp I was synopsizing, I thought of quitting. And then I remembered James, Henry James' admonition to the writer, to be the person on whom nothing is lost. And so I decided I could lie about the West better than any of the authors I was reading. And that was how the first novel came to be written. I had the impulse to parody the Western, but as I worked on the book, I realized that the West was a vast, barren plain. I'd never been there. I'd seen Western movies, of course, kind of a rock-strewn universe, at least as I imagined it, in which a few stick figures were trying to provide themselves a civilization. So my desire to parody the genre was turned gradually during the course of the novel into a serious engagement with its possibility. So if I could write in counterpoint to the Western conventions, there would be parody, if not in tone, then in structure. And all this came to me in the instant of that image's realization. From the very first sentence, I had the voice of the narrator in the situation in which he found himself. And I thought I did pretty well. The book was published, and
it was Welcome to Hard Times.
Welcome to Hard Times, it's called. And it's a novel set in the Dakota Territories in the 1870s, and the reviews were pretty fair, enough to certify me as a writer. I thought I'd done a sound piece of work, that I'd pulled it off just as one of my favorite writers, Kafka, had in his first novel, which he called America, which he wrote without ever having left Prague. And then, I guess this is the story you want me to tell, I received a letter from an elderly lady in Texas. By the way, I'd never been west of Ohio when that book was published. I'd gone to Kenyon College in Ohio. I thought Ohio was the West. But anyway, she wrote this letter, and she said, "Young man, I was with you all the way until your Mr. Jenks at his campsite out on the flats made himself a dinner of the roasted haunch of a prairie dog. At that moment, I knew you'd probably never been west of Ohio, because the haunch of a prairie dog wouldn't fill a teaspoon." Well, I said what I had to say in my reply to her. I said, "What you may be right about today's prairie dogs, madam, but in the 1870s. But the point is, I've let that, in Jenks, hunger might have magnified his measly portion of prairie dog into a dinner. These people were quite poor and struggling, but right or wrong, I've left the line in all subsequent editions of the book. I'm leery of perfection. And there's a story by Nathaniel Hawthorne called The Birthmark about perfection. And in that story, a natural scientist insists on concocting a potion that will erase this birthmark from his beautiful young wife's cheek. He regards it as the one blemish on her perfection. But because she loves him, his wife drinks the potion, and the birthmark, sure enough, slowly fades until her beauty is at last perfect. And at that moment, she dies. And that's why I've left Jenks still out there on the flats having for dinner a roasted haunch of prairie dog.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email is totn@npr.org. And let's start with Joseph, who joins us on the line from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering, just based on how you described some of your earlier writings, if you think you experienced perfectionism as a writer in trying to get things down too perfectly, and if that blocked your process and then also how you got over that.
Well, of course you want to make things as good as they can possibly be. Eventually you discover that what you've done will please you or not please you, and the idea of perfection really doesn't come into it at all. You can speak retrospectively about a book you've written. Sometimes you pick up a book and look at it years later and find a page and think, oh God, how could I have written that? And then you know you haven't achieved perfection. But if you're a perfectionist and you're obsessive, that's a certain advantage to being a writer. But of course, as with all good ideas, as with all impulses, it can be carried too far.
I used to keep a picture of Harvey Haddix over my typewriter. He was, of course, pitched the greatest game in baseball history, perfect for 12 innings, and then lost it in the 13th. So to illustrate the futility of perfection, which I don't think I ever had a real problem with because I rarely achieved it.
You have to want to be perfect, but at the same time know that you never will be.
Thank you.
Joseph, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Ray, and Ray's on the line from Coral Gables, Florida.
Hello. Greetings to you, Mr. Doctorow.
Thank you.
I want to elicit a comment from you about the subject of African-American influence on your writing. And I teach African-American literature in Florida. But before getting your comment about that, I just want to make a comment to you personally, which I never dreamed I'd have the opportunity to do. But this has been rolling around in my head for several years now. There used to be some controversy with African Americans with regard to your work. It used to be said that you were sort of stealing from the African American voice. And when I was younger, I sort of foolishly went along with this idea after a cursory reading of Ragtime. I had not read it closely enough. But I just wanted to mention to you that the brilliance, the incredible effusiveness and the generosity, the narrative generosity of your writing over the years has won me over entirely. And I think that, in fact, for me personally, Billy Bathgate is the height of that narrative power. And it is just so incredibly moving. What you do, in fact, with the American voice, of which I think African-American narrative power is a part, what you do with the American voice is incredibly moving and profound, and I just wonder to what extent African-American narrative has influenced you.
Well, the books we read and the things we admire and absorb don't necessarily have, in at least for me, an ethnic or a religious identification. And you speak of the African-American voice, and I think, well, what book is that? Is it Ralph Ellison, whose voice is quite different from Toni Morrison, and both of their voices are quite different from Frederick Douglass or from Norzeal Hurston? The African voice or Langston Hughes seems to me to be as complex and as multifarious as any other voice. However, having said that, I suppose it is possible to find inspiration in or traces in the work of a certain kind of, you seem to think, exuberance of power that you, as a scholar of African American work, you recognize, and I'm willing to grant that. I certainly have read everything I can by all the American writers in my life. And I've never distinguished influences particularly or wanted to know what they were, but I'm grateful for them all.
Ray, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Our guest is novelist E.L. Doctorow. His new book is a book of essays, Reporting the Universe. We'll be back after a short break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with E.L. Doctorow, the author of Ragtime, City of God, Billy Bathgate, and numerous other novels. His latest is a book of essays titled Reporting the Universe, which will be in bookstores later this month, and he's with us from our bureau in New York. You're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And one of the things you write about was, as you decided, even at the age of 9, to be a writer, you started reading things differently, looking at every book you read as to, you know, not only to, you know, turn the page and find out what happened, but how is this done? And one of the really interesting essays in your book, you write about approaching the United States Constitution the same way and looking at analyzing it as how it's written and what its voice is.
Yes, well, everything written has a voice, and on the at the bicentennial of the Constitution, I was asked to give a talk down in Philadelphia about the Constitution, and so I thought it would be a good thing, it might be wise to read it. The Constitution is 5,000 words long, but it's very dry stuff, and it reads like 50,000 words. Its voice is the voice of Scripture. It ordains. It projects itself into the future without end. The primary verb is shall. The Congress shall be this. The judiciary shall be that. And this is the way things shall go on forever and ever. And it's self-authenticating. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be impetuous and emotional and a call to arms as the Declaration of Independence is. It assumes its own authority. It's kind of a sacred text of our secular humanist organization in this country. I was quite taken with it finally, yes, not only for what it's done and what it's created for us in all these years, but it's thought to be the collective work of a bunch of lawyers, and sometimes it reads like that with the whereases and hereafters and so on, but it's actually quite remarkable.
One of the curiosities as to in reading this book was you do talk about sacred text a lot in this book and describe the authors of the original religious texts of the Bible and the Quran as colleagues.
Well, you know, in ancient times, only God and his prophets and priests were granted authorship. And it was possible for someone who actually did some... First of all, the sacred texts were all created verbally before they were written down. And stories were passed along, and laws and rules and ethical prescriptions before they were written down. And... it was possible for someone who was writing something down, finally, to believe that God was doing the writing through him, and not to be disrespectful. But writers do get the feeling, all writers, even acknowledged mortal writers of today, that when they're working well, something is coming through them, that they're almost... secretaries to something pushing them as if or as they're a medium for something beyond them. So it's quite natural for the ancient writers to believe that God was doing the writing. And in those days, there was no distinction, of course, between fact and fiction, between ordinary communication and heightened language, or between poetry and science. All the modes of language which we now distinguish according to the situation we're in hadn't been devised. Language was enchanted, and the very act of telling a story carried a presumption of truth. It was when Bacon and Galileo insisted on putting claims of knowledge to the test with observation and experiment that storytelling as a prime means of understanding the world was reduced in authority, so that today... really, it's only children who continue to believe that stories are, by the fact of their being told, true children, I might say, and fundamentalists. But one reading the sacred texts can recognize narrative strategies quite easily, and to appreciate the fact that religious idealism and worship did not ignore the need of the needs of storytelling. As with many stories today, especially mystery stories, the writer knows what the ending will be and works out the story to get to that ending. If you know that people die, you construct a story to account for that, the Garden of Eden, and it's a beautiful story of Adam and Eve and the eating the forbidden fruit, and it creates a narrative line that gets you to the end, and, and in doing so, proposes an enormous moral principle that becomes very, very valuable. You know that people are, in different parts of the world speak different languages. Well, how do you account for that? Well, you tell the story of the Tower of Babel, and that's the way it gets you there. The thing about the sacred text is that they still carry a presumption of truth from the stories they tell, as no contemporary, by contemporary I mean certainly in the past 500, 800, 900 years, no contemporary writer can claim. As a matter of fact, you mentioned Emerson before, and it's possible to consider this whole issue of terrorism and the monstrosity of it. We might describe the terror inflicted by the religiously brainwashed nihilists of Al-Qaeda as arising from that part of the world where, for many people, the universe is not the possibility of being reported because it's been counted for and attributed in its entirety in a sacred text. So one way of understanding the underlying conflict we now have is between the fanatical readers of the old and the impertinent writers of the new, between the ancient revealed as divine writings and the writings of our later civilizations whose authors are mortal, not necessarily moral, but mortal and multiple, and in fact lacking any holy credential or need necessary exemption from evil of their own, they're engaged in reporting the universe.
Let's get some more listeners involved. Lewis joins us now on the line from Granville, Ohio.
Yes, hello, Lewis Middleman. Mr. Doctorow, I want to say how pleased I was to hear you speak of stories as perhaps the first means of transmitting knowledge. I have thought for a long time that perhaps stories are called stories because they store things, and what they store are cultures. And when we say that something is in store for you, well, what's in store for a person in a given culture is what is in story in that culture.
Well, that's a pretty good idea. I think it could be argued. You could probably make a case for that.
Thank you.
Okay, Lewis.
Thank you very much. I love hearing you talk about writing.
Thanks very much, Lewis, for the call.
Bye.
Let's go to Janet, and Janet's on the line from Boise, Idaho.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Doctorow, I wondered whether you thought that the new predominance of memoir and creative nonfiction has made readers and the public in general kind of lose respect for works of the imagination?
Oh, no, of course not, because memoirs are quite imaginary.
True.
In biographies as well. You know, when Ragtime was published, I was criticized for creating a fiction about the great financial tycoon J.P. Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to tell my critic that if he really wanted to read a fiction about Morgan, he should read his authorized biography. there is truly a has been a blur of genres, not just literary, but all the genres in the past 50 years in this country. And it is also true that someone who sits down to write a memoir will necessarily write a composition. I mean, you have materials, whether they're materials from other people's lives or your own, you do have to make the composition. And the act of making the composition will bend and shape what you imagine the truth is. So you've got to be careful about memoirs, especially if they're defensive and self-justifying.
Yes. Just to follow on that, I teach creative writing, and frequently when I give an assignment, for example, to write a persona poem, students will object because I'm asking them to lie, or I'm asking them, you know, to stretch the truth. And I guess that's where my question comes from.
Well, I don't know how old your students are, but you better get them to shape there.
Okay, will
well,
do.
In that regard, would you tell us the story of you were in the Bronx High School of Science in a journalism class, and tell us the story of Carl the Doorman?
Oh, yes. Well, that was a very significant story in my life. But I went to the Bronx High School of Science, and I really had a terrible time there. I was surrounded by brilliant children who went around predicting correctly, as it turned out, that they would win the Nobel Prize in physics and chemistry. So in self-defense, I gravitated down the hall to the literary magazine called Dynamo and huddled there with other misplaced students. At any rate, one day I had an opportunity as a budding writer to join a journalism class, which I liked. I didn't care what kind of writing I did at that point. And we learned all the journalism things, who, what, why, where, and when, the way you write a lead and so on. None of that particularly interested me. And then we were asked to go out and interview someone and write an interview. And I really took to that assignment and went out and showed a good deal of initiative and came back with an interview from the stage doorman at Carnegie Hall. He was an old Jewish refugee who'd gotten out of Europe just ahead of Hitler. He had no family. His name was Carl, and he'd come to work every day in a sort of mismatched jacket and trousers, and he would have his lunch in a paper bag and a thermos of tea, and he liked to drink his tea in the old world way by sipping it through a cube of sugar, which he placed between his teeth. And all the great musicians at Carnegie Hall, the great recitalists, knew him and loved him because he was so sweet-tempered, and also he had great knowledge of music and the great violinist Heifetz and Toscanini, the great conductor, and Vladimir Horowitz, the great pianist. They all made a point of stopping and talking to Carl the doorman. And I turned in this assignment, and I was called up to the teacher's desk and afterwards, and she said this was absolutely the best interview she'd ever read in all the years she'd been assigning this, running this class. It was so good, she wanted to do it, run it in the school newspaper. And she said, what I'd like to do is send one of the photography students down to Carl and take his picture to go along with the story in the paper. Well, I hadn't expected that kind of enthusiasm from my teacher. And I said, well, I don't think you can do that to Carl. And she said, why not? I said, well, he's very shy. And the teacher said, what do you mean he's shy? He talked to you, didn't he? And I said, well, not exactly. There is no Carl. I made him up. And, you know, at that age, you accept adult criticism, and neither my teacher or I realized this was a great portent of my future, but what I got was an F and an admonition, and I was lucky not to be taken to the principal's office. But it was really a great moment. And to get serious for a second, the sense of transgression I had when I was doing that fake interview is the same feeling that I've discovered you must have when you write anything, that if you're going to write anything that's any good, you'll have to have this sense of breaking some rule, violating some custom, transgressing, doing something slightly forbidden or even greatly forbidden. At that point, if you have that feeling, the work will be going well. Of course, if I was defending myself from my teacher now, I'd simply say that I had been doing what journalists have always done.
We're speaking with the sinner and novelist E.L. Doctorow. He's with us from our bureau in New York. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our phone number, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Here's an email we got on totn@npr.org from Keith. Mr. Doctorow, what do you think of the new fiction of younger writers? Do you feel there has developed in the past 20 years a dominant style that sounds truncated and clipped? I hear it in many younger writers and believe it may have as its influence both television and Hemingway. What say you?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. There are a lot of good young writers coming up, and what I do know has nothing to do with style, really. I cannot detect, to the extent that I've done as much reading as I don't think I've done as much as I should have, but, you know, when you're writing fiction, it's a little difficult to read it. But in any event, what I discovered, I was asked to edit an anthology of stories, the best short stories of 2000 for Houghton Mifflin. That's an annual anthology they put out. And I read about 150 stories to choose 20 or 21 of them. And what I discovered about these young writers was a rather marvelous thing that, you choose them without knowing who they are or what magazine they or journal they've been printed in. And it turned out that I chose a preponderance of stories from what we might call first generation or immigrant generation young writers. There were Asian writers, Japanese, Chinese, Caribbean writers, Latino writers, a writer from Bosnia. And what I did discover is this tendency of the younger writers to revert to the longer, more relaxed form of the tale. For many, many years, the short story has been dominated by the sort of classic form developed by Joyce and practiced by Hemingway, where the story opens very close to, in time to the point where it will end, where the climax comes. But these younger writers have spread things out a little more in the way the older narratives told their stories. And so I would say if we're looking for any sign of what's happening in our literature, that some of the conventions are being broken and people are finding their voices with more of a sense of freedom than they might have 20 years ago.
Our guest is E.L. Doctorow, and we'll come back from a short break after and have a couple of more questions with him. Plus, we'll talk about May Day in Havana and take a look ahead at the weekend's 129th running of the Kentucky Derby. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 50 years ago, James Watson and Francis Crick figured out the double helix structure of DNA. Join Ira Flatow on tomorrow's Science Friday for a conversation with James Watson about his life in genetics. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, our guest is E.L. Doctorow. His new book is Reporting the Universe. And we have an email from Corey Campbell in Minneapolis, who writes, I was recently in London and saw the stage adaptation of Mr. Doctorow's novel Ragtime. I wanted to ask his opinion of the show.
Well, I haven't seen this particular production. I understand it's somewhat different from the one that opened in New York and played here for a couple of years. I can speak about the show generally, that I really appreciate what those people have done. They're very responsive to the book and tried to be as faithful to it as they could. I love the music. I think the lyrics are quite brilliant. And the staging of the original show was awesome. It's not the book. I mean, structurally, it follows the three families quite closely. Mm-hmm. But there's this kind of a naughtiness in the book, a kind of a satirical eroticism and perhaps a kind of a mock historical voice on occasions that they don't pick up in the show, and it has a kind of a sentimental ending. But apart from that, I really think they've done a pretty fine job.
Okay. Let's get one last caller in. Jack joins us from Olean, New York.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Mr. Doctorow.
Hi.
Hello.
Couple quick questions. Earlier you said writers often feel like a secretary's pushing them. Is that like amanuensis?
Yeah, when you're working well, you're not yourself. It's something else seems to be going on inside of you. All writers discover this, that there's this quality.
Excellent. I have your interview that appeared in New York Story magazine. It was an excellent interview. I kept that. But my main question is, what is your favorite book that you have published? Do you have one? And who is your favorite writer, if you have one?
Oh, I was hoping no one would ask me those questions. But, you know, you do the book, and you just hope that it works. And you can't have a favorite. Perhaps the one you're working on has to be your favorite. The one I'm working on now is my favorite. The favorite author. I mean, why discriminate? Literature is in a horse race.
Right.
You don't have one winner.
Yeah.
There's so many. I mean, just read everything and everyone, and you'll find that you can understand that literature is an entire universe.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I have to ask you this. You were named after Edgar Allan Poe, right?
Yes.
All I've ever read, you know, all of your books are published under E.L. Doctorow. And what do your friends call you, Ed?
Edgar is what they call me. But they have to be very good friends to call me that. You know, I was named after Poe. That's absolutely true. And Poe was my father's favorite writer. He loved a lot of bad writers. He loved James Fenimore Cooper, too. But I'm consoled in that Poe is our greatest bad writer. We couldn't be what we are without him. But finally, a few years ago, before my mother died, I was talking to her, and I said, do you realize you and Dad named me after an alcoholic, drug-addicted, delusional paranoid with strong necrophiliac tendencies? And she said, Edgar, that's not funny.
Who is your favorite writer, Mr. Doctor?
I was very pleased to be named Edgar when I was a boy, because I knew he was one of the authors in that card game called Authors. And you know, when you name children, there's always an injunction involved, isn't there? You're suggesting, you're planting a seed in the child's mind somehow. And this in itself will not create a fate, but if it goes along with other things, like a lot of books in the house and a lot of good storytellers in the family and a lot of musicians, somehow all these things combined, and they do have a certain impulsive quality in the young person.
Jack, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate the call, and Mr. Doctorow, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
E.L. Doctorow's new book out in bookstores this month is Reporting the Universe.